I've been kicked off a course for wearing white socks.
I was just going to
tell you. On the third hole, they came and fetched me with a golf cart. On the third hole, they followed me. We are joined this afternoon, actually, now with Michael Scholtz. Michael Scholtz turned a pro in end of 93. I think a lot of people will know him, and I'll let him run with that a little bit. But Michael has been in the game of golf for a very long time. You've got an extremely interesting profile, Michael. Your personality it far exceeds anything you've ever done in golf. You know,
my wife might beg to.
But it's always the most incredible positive feedback when anybody speaks about you, and anybody in any circles that you travel in. You've also entertained people in golf for a very long time, decades now, and you also play on the senior tour part time every now and again to retain that. But then you also in business, and you started that journey in 1997. That is a short intro, but that gives the audience just understanding as to why you're sitting here today. We're trying to grow the game of golf. We're also trying to break the snobbish part of golf. And just to say that people are just people behind it. We're all just trying to make a living in what we do. We're not always perfect. But we try and do what we do well in golf. So Michael, welcome to it. And Arthur, that is co-hosted by Arthur Horn and by Marais Fasahi from TrueFit. So welcome also, Arthur, and thank you for once again joining us. I'm not always sure why I'm in this particular side of the seat. I think because I talk the most cock.
I'll get you there.
But welcome, Michael, and thank you very much for the privilege for you to be here this morning.
Yeah, thank you. I think you've just told me stuff about myself that I don't know, but thanks so much for that. But it's been I've had an interesting career in the game, and I think the career is conducive to it. You know, I mean, looking back a few years ago, I mean, I met Arthur. He was playing in Swaziland, and I was still playing as a full-timer on the Sunshine Tour, and I played with his dad. And along came this 12-year-old boy who was playing along with, and he was as nervous as anything. And now he's sitting next to him in a chair with a beard, and he's becoming a dad and all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah, so times have changed.
I had hair back in those days, Arthur, you might remember. But it's been an interesting journey. I've pretty much done most things in golf, but it's been a lot of fun. The playing career kind of ended a little prematurely. I always had intention of going back and never really did. But I consider myself a part-timer when I play now. I play okay. I was lucky. I had a natural ability with hand-eye coordination. So the trick shot shows, I'll beg to differ that I'm the best in the world. But there was a guy called Chuck Heiter. And if anyone's watching, go and Google the guy, man. He's just insane. He was a pro baseball player. He could just hit shots that, he was literally swinging with a 10-pound hammer and doing one-arm push-ups from a trick shot, in difficulty. And then, I learned through Dale Hayes and Dave Usendorf, and Dale learned through a guy called DeHaan, who was he pioneered trick shots. And I got sucked into it, and thanks, Dale, for that. Ruined my life. I'm sure you'll have Dale on at some stage. But, Dale was the pioneer. So it's all about the stories and the comedy. And, I'm blessed with an ability to hit bouncing balls and stuff like that. But, it's all about the story. You have a guy hitting the greatest shots in the world. And I think there were a lot of guys who, did the YouTube blogs and stuff. But put them in front of a live audience, and they're doing 25 takes to get one shot. You've got to be able to do it there on the spot. And difficulty factor, obviously, is important. But the story's behind it. But, and you've got to keep them current. So I'm starting to mention names in my shows now where guys are going, who's he? Dale. Nobody remembers some of the guys you talk about. So, but, Dale was my mentor when it came to that. And he got me into it. But, it's brilliant. And it was I always looked at it relative to the order of merit, every year, what the guys were earning. And I'd look at how many shows I'd done and I featured quite nicely on the order of merit. So, I obviously lost the time to play, But I pegged myself quite high up in the order of merit.
You also had a TV show with Dave.
Yeah, so that was a bit of a short-lived career, and it was brilliant. I mean, I worked with Dave Usendorf, who is my mentor. I consider Dave
and hopefully we'll have
him on the show at some stage. And Dave just epitomized the industry because he's such a good businessman, unbelievable forward thinker, and never overlooked an opportunity, you know. And I think we all have it. I mean, I was very fortunate by the people that I've been surrounded with. But I remember a lovely story about a guy who I was playing on the Challenge Tour, and a mate of mine came to me and he said, my brother's going to be a world beater. You know, you hear that a lot and you just overlook it. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And then I wound up, when I was playing golf in England, part of the Challenge Tour, I found myself in Northants. And I phoned him up and I said, listen, let's have a game. And I played golf with this 14-year-old boy who just won the Hampshire Hog. And I think I shot 67. You know, I was playing, you know, budding European tour player. And this kid of 14 shot 64. Justin Rose.
Justin Rose, world beater.
So, you know, you when someone says they've got an opportunity in the game, or, you know, just don't cast them aside, because there's so many ideas, especially this industry with the technology that's involved nowadays, and the opportunity, the people that are involved. You know, you guys had Eric Van Rooyen here early on. A finer gent you shall not meet.
Yeah.
You know, and it's amazing how he's just a normal guy, you know, with a normal lifestyle.
I keep saying it.
You know, and I think people see, you know, these guys on TV and think they are unique, and they're normal people, you know. They've got, you know, normal problems. So, yeah, I'd like to have some of those problems too. But, you know, never overlook an opportunity. And that's so important. And, you know, with Dave working on the TV stuff was so much fun.
Looked like, you know, a lot of fun.
You know, well, and, you know, we had a bit of a cult following. And before they killed Super Golf, when I say killed it, I mean, it was, they just found that there wasn't enough viewership in Super Sport then, and then decided to get rid of it. And it was great fun. We used to have a rule.
It was my favorite part of the show, out of the whole
show. Well, it did.
What part was it?
Yeah. Well, we did the rules. So we started a thing called Golf 101. Okay.
Yes. Okay.
And initially, it was a bit broader than that. And I approached Super Sport before that with a couple of ideas. And they eventually said, okay, well, look, let's start somewhere and do the rules of golf. But we do them with you and Dave. And Dave is he's a storyteller like no other. I mean, he can say hello and you'll laugh.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I'll compliment that by somehow, you know, we just throw a little bit of a Tweedledum and a Tweedledummer, you know, in there. And we used to have a rule amongst us that we'd only do it in one take.
Mm.
So if you buggered it up, it still floated like that. So, you know, there were so many fun moments where, you know, Dave would always say, two-shot penalty. And you go, oh, Dave, it's not a two-shot penalty, it's a penalty. But anyway, it would go out, and then we'd aggravate someone, and someone would phone in and say, well, it's only a one-shot penalty. But the engagement that we got, we had a few guys who would phone in, and Super Sport would say, oh, so-and-so phoned in and complained that you guys have, you know, got the rules wrong. And more often than not, we were actually right. And we had some quite senior people phoning up and saying that we got a rule wrong, but we, you know, obviously we researched it before. But we had fun doing it, and we weren't mocking the rules, but we were having fun like average Joe would do in a situation like that. So, you know, I mean, I remember jumping off a boat, you know, at Ibotsi into the water just as part of the show, and Dave smashing eggs on my head. So we just added a bit of a different light to it, and it was great fun. And, you know, it was a pity Dave then moved to Mauritius for a contracted period.
I remember.
And we never continued it. And I think now we're both out of time. But it was such a fun way of, you know, taking the rules, which are serious, and just lightheartedly shedding some light on why and how.
And you're educating the guys again, making it fun.
Yeah.
Guys learning a trick or two about rules. It's important.
And it's quite amazing. I mean, I had a lot of, you know, youngsters, you know, coming up and saying, oh, you guys must make a fortune. And really, we were doing it more for the fun. I mean, I'd love to say we made a profit out of it. But it was, you know, we'd shoot all four for the month. We'd shoot four episodes in a morning. We'd plan them. And it was great fun. And we also, our producer, he was just fantastic as well. So they all bought into it, and we crashed drones, and we did all kinds of crazy stuff. But, you know, golf needed a bit of craziness. It's become, you know, now with the youth, and that's where so much is happening. You know, loud trousers are now the norm. You know?
Yeah.
And it's golf. Golf has to evolve, and it is. And that's the, you know, like a show like this now. This is exactly what it's about, guys. You know, you've got so many serious interviews with so many serious people, and you know, you do a serious interview with a guy like Eric. He'll give you serious answers, but I'm sure you guys had a lot of fun with him.
No, we did. Amazing.
And yeah, that originally Golf 101 was supposed to be interviewing guys like Jaco van Sail.
Yeah.
And what they didn't know about Jaco is that he's a paraglider, you know.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Well, there you go. So, you know, take a look at the golfer and have a look at the fun. Doug McGuigan. I wanted to do a slot called Giggles with McGuiggles. Okay, and this is a perfect platform. You need to do that because there's a guy you'll meet, and Doug is 51 now. Okay, he's playing on the senior tour, but the guy's the funniest guy you'll ever meet. He's always got a one-liner chip for anything. So I mean, he was telling a story about the other day. I try to spend a bit of time with him. I'm down in Georgia a lot building bunkers, and I get to spend. And we're both Liverpool, staunch Liverpool supporters, and. He was telling a story about one of the guys that we used to play golf with. He was a very heavy set guy, and I won't mention his name, but he was a very heavy set guy. And Doug hadn't seen him for years, and he saw him. And Doug said to the guy, "He said, yeah, you're looking all right." And he says, "Yeah, can you see how much weight I've lost?" And he said to the guy, "He said, listen, you could lose 20 kilos. It's like throwing a deck chair off the Titanic. Nobody will notice." And that's Doug McGuigan. Yeah. That was a chip. It's very similar to Dave Usendorf. So you have to, I mean, Giggles with McGuigan is going to be
wonderful.
A permanent fixture where Doug just gets up and does a minute little chat about something and throws the guys off, you know. But like throwing a deck chair off the Titanic. Brilliant.
Yeah.
You know? And Usendorf is the same. So, you know, there's time to be serious in the game of golf. And, you know, these guys make a living out of it, you know. And maybe we just chat about the Live Tour on that, you know. What's your opinion on the Live Tour? You know, might as well throw it in there because I think it's current.
It's a tough one. It's a hot topic right now. I think it's good for the game. I always compare it to like a premiership football player. They're earning 200 to 300,000 pounds a week.
A week.
Why can't a golf athlete do that as well? 54 holes per tournament is a bit of a tough one to swallow. One and no cut.
I totally agree. I'm going to interject there because, you know, I think when you're trying to do something different, often you don't have to break the mold by too much.
Yeah.
So exactly that. You look at 72 holes is the way it's always been played. And the cut, and I think Faldo had a big statement to say about the cut, and I agree with it. But, you know, they're obviously trying to turn it on its head. And that's a good thing. It is like IPL cricket. It was also scorned at one stage.
Yeah,
completely.
But yeah, so I mean, 100%. So that's hard. It's a hard pill to swallow. But I think they can fix that.
I do think they can adapt. I think adaptation is huge.
So you want you're saying the competitiveness that for the cut is still something that is very relevant. I think that is probably the one argument that a lot of people agree with. You know, how fair is it for the players to run through entirely until the end of the tournament?
You know, I mentioned to you guys a little early on about, you know, about there's a massive public outcry and there's a lot of pros and, you know, when I say professional golfers who also voicing their opinions and, you know, you've got to ask yourself why they're taking sides, etc. And I say it's quite simple. You know, with regards to business, you know, people and viewers now will be running a business. And if you look at why do you run a business, yes, you got to love what you do. Okay. And I've known you for a while and everything you get involved in, you love what you do. I watched Arthur build a brilliant business, okay, out of something he loves.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's great. But at the end of the day, you run a business to make money. Okay. You run a business to expand and then you run a business to be able to make the business run more easily, okay? So for efficiency. So you run a business to make more money, but also to then make things more efficient, so to work less.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what the Live Tour does. Mm. They're saying to these guys, we acknowledge you're the best in the world, or were the best, or you've won so many majors. Yes, you might be in the later years of your career, but then again, IPL did the same thing. It was great watching Shane Warne.
It was awesome. Absolutely.
And I believe he was still on the, you know, on the Australian. You know, they pretty much said whenever he wanted to come back, he could. He was that good. And, you know, the guys are saying Stenson is past his sell-by date. There's no ways. You look at guys like, I mean, and now Mickelson, they're saying he's playing rubbish. The guy, what, he's the oldest player to ever win a major. And he's in a little bit of a slump now. And the good news is, from a slump, after a slump, you come back again. So he's on a little bit of a slump now. But these guys aren't past their sell-by date. These are guys who can still win tournaments. Yes, they might not be in there every week. But you look at the guys who are joining that tour now. All they want to do is to make more money. That's the objective. Work less and have a better lifestyle. That's business. So for any viewers out there who have an attitude about how dare they, they're not loyal to us anymore, then have a look at yourself. It's hypocritical to say, oh, well, that's not fair. Why is Dustin Johnson on that tour? He should be. He doesn't owe you anything. You know, he's giving you great viewership. And most certainly the LIV Tour is not promising less viewership.
Yeah,
they're just going about it in a different way. And they're creating a different opportunity for players. And I think at some stage the tours will come together.
And I think the team format's also unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Brilliant.
So you're watching individual plus team sports, and now you've got two things to look at. You can look at your favorite players, and then you can, you know, choose your favorite team, and I think it's great.
And sports betting, you know, you know, as much I don't bet. I'm not a betting man. Okay, if you invite me, Arthur, to play golf, we're playing for 10-10, 20-10. That's it, okay. But that's all I've got, okay. But not only that, but I play Super Brew. We all, in a way, if we're not betting, we're betting on ego.
Yeah.
Okay. And that, once again, with a team aspect of it. Now, you're not picking one player, you're picking four players. Okay, and that's brilliant. So, you know, and I you know, Greg Norman pioneered the WGC all those years ago. People forgot that and gave it to the tours. It's now the flagship behind the majors anyway. That was Norman's idea.
Mm.
So, you know, you can't shun him either. And he's a superbly successful businessman. He's probably the most successful businessman who's been pro golf and then moved out. And you can't take anything away from Gary Player and Nick Klaus and those guys. But Norman is an unbelievable businessman. So he's not going to do much wrong in terms of a business model. As you say, it doesn't, for me, it doesn't fit well with the 54 holes. But that can be repaired. You know, when you're creating something new, you can fix as you go along. And I think that will, I think it'll fix itself.
Yeah, but Michael, I mean, I'm just a thought, yeah, but over the years, there's been a lot of disruptors in golf. You know, I remember putting styles used to be a disruptor on the tour, which got banned on a lot of tours. That
broomsticks.
Correct.
Yeah.
That is, you know, it's been ongoing for quite some time, that controversial stuff, or at least perceived controversial stuff. But if it's going the grain of golf, if it's making it more exciting for amateurs to watch, because I take nothing away from the fathers that's done so well and put foundations of golf in place, but it's amateurs that support it. You know, it's viewerships that drive it. You know, the 1% never worry. They never buy equipment. They never buy. They get sponsored everything. The economy around golf is the everyday person. I'll include myself, not the two of you, but the everyday man like myself that chooses to watch it. I think it's been incredible. I think it's been good for South Africa. You know, and we're not here to take a position on left or right. I'm just saying, for the game of golf, it's brilliant. And I think that the egos need to work it out, because the rest of us want it. I don't know if that.
Yeah, look, you know, also it's evolutionary.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way it is.
100%.
You know, and you've also got to get things wrong, you know, to change things. So if you look at, you know, any sport and you want to attract the youngsters, I mean, if you look at the Valera every year and they got that stadium hole, if you'd done that in the 80s, okay. They would have taken that tournament off the register.
Correct.
But it's become part of what it is. It's now become, it's almost like a celebration. You look at those people there, they're not thugs or hooligans or whatever. These are businessmen who run big businesses and have yachts. And they're out there cheering and tossing beer over the players, and the players are loving it.
It's creating a bit of chaos.
You know, ask the players now what's their favorite hole on the tour. I guarantee on the PGA Tour, they will say it's that 17th hole. Without a doubt. And it's different, and different becomes, you know, obviously easier to accept once people start embracing it. And I, you know, as I say, you know, if the Saudis have got the money to be able to help the game, I mean, you think what it could do for South African golf and Asian golf, the tours that aren't the big tours. You know, it's one tournament.
Look what it did to Andy Dimitri.
In terms of money, could literally fund a whole smaller tour. So I think there's massive scope for the day, and I like where it's going. And I'm sorry that people are upset about it, but also, once again, you've got a very big entity trying to protect what they claim to own.
Yeah.
But they don't own people's lives. They've got a contract. But, you know, once again, they're also they're a contractor. They're a contractor themselves.
Yeah.
So, and I watch both. I love PGA Tour, and I watch European Tour, and I watch LIV. I think it's brilliant. I'm just sad that there's not, you know, there's not a common flow of blood going between them, and I think it'll happen.
It'll eventually happen.
It's the only tour that you can watch on YouTube Live, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, it's the only tour, you know,
legally
that you're allowed to watch on the you know, on their YouTube channel, which is, you know, I'm on YouTube all the time. It's good. It's nice to go in. And what I like about it, I can rewind and forward. Mm. And also to look at favorite moments and et cetera. So I think they've made it brilliantly engaging. And I think the other tours are going to embrace it, learn from it, and adapt it in their own way as well. You know, Arthur, if fitting companies are innovating around the world and they're doing it differently, whether it be them, how they market themselves, whether it be how they approach the fitting process. I mean, in the beginning, you might, out of jealousy, you know, sort of push against it in a way. And I don't mean to put it that way, but eventually it gets embraced and it's like, that's wonderful, and let's make sure that we keep being innovative. Because, Michael, golf can be seen as quite a old guard, you know, only for rich people. And I think what I like absolutely is that I want to play a role in saying that's just nonsense. That, you know, if you think about how your mates and play, the stuff that we say to each other on the golf course, the way that we interact with each other, I always call that chirping our love language. If I don't get chirped, I feel like something's off or wrong.
You've got a golf society whose name you cannot mention yet. Okay, so it's exactly that. It's fun. You know, it's going out with the boys, and it's great. You know, expensive, Arthur. You know, if you look at expensive, you know, there was a big shift at one stage from golf to mountain biking. What does a mountain bike cost? I was a mountain biker. This pretty heavy set fella here was 74 kilos. I was doing the non-stop Sarnie in these races, okay? My bike cost 20 times more than my golf club.
Oh, for sure.
So they can't say it was a costing that suddenly our mountain biking grew. You know, so I always said, you know, that the mountain bikers will come back to golf. And I'm right. Will. After COVID, they're all coming back, okay? And it was quite amazing because there I was super fit and we would go for a ride. We'd go to the Mug and Bean. We'd meet there. We'd ride off. We'd come in. They wouldn't let us inside because you smell now, okay? You've been sweating. You've done 60 k's on a mountain bike and you come back. You can't have a beer with the boys there, okay? You can, but now you've got to ride back or you've got to then drive your car elsewhere. And the silly thing was that when I play golf, I talk. When I mountain bike, I talked, and they swore at me, saying, just shut up already, okay? What's the point? That's not socializing mountain biking. Yeah. Yes, it's like it's competitive and whatever, but there's nothing finer than going out on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning playing with your mates. You've had a long week. You've had a few interesting things happen to you.
Yeah.
And you have a conversation. You engage. And that's where I think, you know, COVID, people started missing that social interaction. And that's why golf has spiked a little bit.
Mm.
And it's back. Golf is back. And yes, it spiked and then spend went down a bit. And you will have seen that with your studios. Guys came, you know, running in the door.
Correct.
But it's now reaching a stage where it's now got a bit of equilibrium.
It wasn't sustainable, you know, that growth we saw. Not forever.
But it showed people once again that golf was actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's a pretty cool place to be is on a golf course.
Yeah.
Correct.
But once again, you know, you look at the shifts, and this is a shift. It's just a forced shift. I mean, I remember when I was playing golf, Clinton Whitelaw, the name, you know, probably rings a bell, won the ESSA Open in 1993 or 1993, and then he won the Moroccan Open in 1997. Great golfer, got very distracted very quickly. But Clinton Whitelaw and I did the strangest thing back in those days. We went to go and see a sports psychologist, and we didn't tell anyone because if we did, they would think we were weird and they'd probably lock us away in a padded cell. This was in 1995. We went to Ken Jennings, and we didn't tell anyone because if you went to a psychologist, you were sick in the head. You tell me one professional golfer on tour now who doesn't.
That's
just evolution.
Yeah.
So everyone, now it's not normal not to go to one. Gary Player.
Yeah. Oh, for
he
sure.
was shunned by so many. For what sure. are you doing? Look at him now.
Exactly.
He's still doing Fosbury flops and double sidewinders, okay? And you watch when he opens the Masters. You know, Jack Nicklaus battles to walk.
Mm.
Gary Player is still doing flick flacks and you know, those kind of things. And he was singing that tune, you know, not just, and, you know, and I love, Mr. Player, I love you to bits. I really do. I'm a big fan. And South African, I want to mention this because I mentioned this in all my trick shot shows. I do a little Gary Player impersonation, and I've done it in front of Mr. Player at the Nelson Mandela Invitationals a number of times, where all the push-ups. If you're not a fan of Gary Player, okay, why? And I can tell you, South Africans, we're strange people. There's a slight jealousy factor, I think, but they confuse arrogance and confidence.
Mm.
And Gary Player is the most confident person you'll ever meet. He never says a negative word about anything or anyone, ever.
Mm.
He'll rather take the positive, and he's often frowned upon by saying, yeah, well, that was rubbish. Mr. Player, you're a hero, and you're South Africa's greatest sportsman ever, and you keep doing Fosbury flops and flick flacks and all those things. Because let me tell you what, when he was doing that all those years ago, now it's evident that you should be doing
correct.
It.
So, yeah.
Us as youngsters, there we go, 52. Yeah. Learn from that because I want to be that guy who can still do that at
absolutely.
That age. And it was because he set the ground rules. So for the young pros who now recognize the fact that exercising, not gymming, exercising. A lot of guys have hurt themselves by going a bit too heavy on the weights, is my belief. And at some stage, I'm sure you'll get Garth Milnin or some of the sports scientists.
Few, yeah.
But yeah, they're also taming back on the weights. You're not a bodybuilder. You just want to be fit.
Yeah.
Eric Van Rooyen.
Yeah. Perfect body motion.
You know? Just literally working with, and Gary Player always said work with your own body weight. And that, you know, you look at him today. 84 years of age. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Mm. He was just recently in South Africa. I think
he's
it was
here
like
at the moment.
Oh, is he at the moment? Yeah. And he showed a video on his Instagram where he was doing exercising in his pool. Like he was just going back and forth. And I tell you what, I felt exactly the same. At that age, that I can have that type of energy, what a blessing.
Mm.
You know, what a blessing to be able to do that. But when you say that, if you go back to the 95 World Cup, nay, rugby, the guys were doctors and had businesses because that's what they did. You couldn't just be. You know, but now look at where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
And I like what you said there about the evolution. And Michael, when you say those type of things, you're a very young mind, you know, at heart, because not a lot of people can see it that way. We're saying it's a disruption in your view now, but it's going to become the norm, you know, in 10 years from now. And somebody has to start that process. You know, Bryson DeChambeau, in my opinion, went through very similar when he started going for the weight training, the speed training, and he started disrupting. And I don't know, everybody forgets, but he brought back that one putting style.
Or arm lock.
Arm lock style, which they then banned, you know, again, I think 4 or 5 weeks after he played his first tour like that, but he disrupted it. But then if you look in the behind the man, the hard work that he puts in, you know, we have videos of him at, you know, the tournament's done, everybody's gone home, 8 o'clock at night, he's sitting there and he's just hitting balls, you know, like a mad guy. So I've respected his work ethic and the way that he's put it into. I just want to flip you a little bit to the Sunshine Tour name. So the Sunshine Tour, how competitive do you think our tour is in comparison to the rest of the market?
You know, we produce so many great golfers. Okay, so, and when I say that, in terms of the numbers, you know, if you look at, let's go back, I think a year and a half ago, we had 10 golfers in the top 100. That's how good South African golf
is. Yeah, it was a year and a half ago.
We represent such a small proportion of golfers worldwide. So, and the number is often contested, but we've got about 135,000 registered golfers in South Africa. So, that's not even a number. When you go to the States, you've got 16.8 million golfers.
Yeah.
Okay. We are so small.
Yeah.
In the big picture, however, you know, just the way South Africans live their life. So our schooling system supports sport. Okay, and that's brilliant. Our weather is great all year round. I mean, this is winter now. I mean, I don't know, Arthur. Your blood's a little.
Arthur's sticking by.
You came from Swaziland, so, but. You know, we've got the most amazing weather conditions. Golf is cheap in South Africa. So I want to put this out there. I'm a very proud member of the PGA. Okay, so I'm a PGA member, so a coach as well. And one of my peers came to me the other day and said, yeah, he wanted to play at this golf course, and it was too expensive. And, you know, all the PGA pros, we're a brotherhood, and we all look after each other. And he said, no, well, it wasn't for him. It was for the amateurs he was going to play with. And I said, well, what were they going to charge you? And it's one of the premier golf clubs. And he said they were going to charge, I think it was, I want to just make up a number and say it was R1,000 with a cart. So I said, and yeah? And he said, well, it's way too expensive. And I said to him, are you crazy? Convert that to dollars. Okay, it's not even a number.
Mm.
So golf in South Africa is cheap. Okay, it's dirt cheap to play. And our golf courses are phenomenal. And this is a hats off to all the greenkeepers. I promise you.
Massive, yeah.
On skeleton staff, these guys, and on limited budgets, these guys, and that's the space I bat in now, they do unbelievable jobs of golf courses. Even in the middle of winter, you go and play any golf course in Johannesburg or Pretoria, you will not have a poor experience. Those golf courses are in fantastic condition. So the quality of our golf courses and the design quality of the newer golf courses is exceptional. So we're playing world-class golf courses in conditions you can play all year round.
Yeah.
We've got a schooling system that backs sport. And it's cheap. Okay, when I say cheap, it's not dirt cheap. And also now our development programs are well-supported as well. And thank you, Mr. Rupert, for that.
Yeah.
But and many others. I'm just picking one out there. But, you know, this game, if you go to if you went into the heart of Europe 20 years ago, if your dad wasn't driving a Ferrari or a Lamborghini, you weren't playing golf.
Mm.
So we are so lucky in this country that we could afford to, and the system supports it. So that's why we produce so many great golfers. I've kind of forgotten to steer it off from where the
question. No, you answered it perfectly.
But you know, so the Sunshine Tour, you know, it's unfortunate that the money is not here like it was at one stage, and that's because the big tours have gotten bigger, and have literally. I mean, when I joined the Sunshine Tour, it was the third most lucrative tour in the world. You had the PGA Tour, you had the European Tour, and then it was the Sunshine Tour. And I don't think we're even up with some of the mini tours in the States now, and that's just that's economics. But in terms of the players and the quality of players, so this is this is a great starting tour, and of course it taps in with to the DP Tour now as well. So with the European Tour, so the guys can come out here, and literally you've got a few weeks to make a lot of money, and you get your European Tour card if you play really well.
Mm. Yeah.
So
Thomas had to negotiate some great cards.
It's a stepping tour.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's even a feeder to the Challenge Tour.
It's even a feeder to the Challenge Tour. That was also recently announced. He's done incredible work, in my opinion, on that.
You know, you look at Henny Duplessis.
Yeah.
It's also a stepping tour.
Correct. Yeah.
You know, the guy made, and, you know, I'm not, you know, Sars, please forgive him. He made 55 million rand in the space of three events.
Mm.
Brilliant. There's a guy whose life has changed. I interviewed Mr. Mark McNulty, and I said, Mr., because there's the finest putter I've ever, and the finest gentleman I've ever had the opportunity of being on a golf course with. Now, I interviewed him for a golf day that his daughter was running to raise money for Transvaal Hockey back in the days. And I said to him, so what was the turning point in your career? And he said, winning the $1 million.
Mm.
It was the money that opened the doors for him. He didn't have to worry now financially. In those days, even nowadays, $1 million is a lot of money. But it was just so off the charts.
Mm.
And Mark McNulty didn't have to worry financially anymore because of one event.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening. You look at what's happened with Henny now.
Mm.
And he's a fantastic young golfer. And, you know, I'm sad that some of the the haters are saying Henny is going to be, and he's won tournaments in South Africa, and he's going to win tournaments. But he obviously went to the Live Tour, so he's being scorned for it. But the talent that comes out of this country is insane. And I'm going to say something here now. Okay. We breed tough golfers.
Mm-hmm.
We breed chatting tough
about
golfers.
That before,
watch these guys now. You know, gone are the days now where the guys under pressure start folding. Our guys just get better and better. Mm. You know, they dig their heels in. You know, and Ashley Buhai.
Yeah.
You know, Goosebumps, Ash.
Yeah, goosebumps, Ash.
You have made us so proud.
I was so proud.
There's a girl who, from the age of 12, she won the SA Ladies Open at 14, okay? And, you know, it was a tough life. She didn't really have a normal childhood, okay? And she's lived her whole life playing this game. Make one triple bogey, okay, on the 15th hole in that tournament.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, she's thrown it.
Mm.
It was one hole. The very next hole. And leading up to that, she didn't do anything wrong. She was playing quite nicely, just wasn't going in the hole. And then the last three holes after that were fantastic. So other than one hole, she didn't throw it away.
No.
Okay, and then she went ahead and won it anyway. She went to fetch it. And yeah, and just watching, and that was impressive to me. That 18th hole, to play it five times and not miss the middle of the fairway was insane. Okay, so South Africans are tough. Eric van Rooyen is going to win some big tournaments. Events, yeah. Okay, because he's tough.
Verzadenhout as well.
Christian Verzadenhout as well, I also believe.
You know, and but they're being followed by a swarm.
And Gary Gihu as well. Gary Gihu also a young talent. Very good talent on the market.
I was yesterday, I saw Brandon Stone. I hadn't seen him for a while.
Yeah.
You know, guys are saying, what's happening? He won the Scottish Open 2 years ago. Mm. You know, what, you're not going to win a tournament every week. And, you know, as I say, I love slumps. You know, I wish I was in more slumps than with my golf. Because outside of a slump, you're on the comeback trail. And you know,
those guys have been in the spotlight since they were this big. Exactly. The Brandon Stones, the Ashley Simon back in the day.
Yeah.
Now she's Buai. I mean, everyone, Dylan Fratelli.
Yeah.
They've been under the radar for such a long time, since they were kids. So the minute they crash for 3-4 months, it's now the end of the world for them. But it's actually not. They're just plugging away.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Brandon Grace, you know, funny enough, in my bathroom, I've got a magazine rack, and there's always a look at it, and it's Brandon Grace saying, you know, it's tough to stay patient, you know. But you look at the talent behind the guy, and then, you know, he goes ahead and wins a couple of tournaments. And guys are going, where's he been? He hasn't been anywhere. He just wasn't playing at his best, and now he's back there again. So, yeah, it's and as long as the guys aren't injured, you know, and injury and long term injuries. And I think Bryson, you know, we mentioned him early on, and I think a lot of it is self-sustained. Now, with crack hitting the ball that hard, the body is not supposed to be moved that quickly, and especially, you know, the impact of a golf ball on a golf club. You deal with that stuff in terms, you know, it's not a soft impact. You're going to start causing trouble with your bone structures.
No, it's supposed
to swing it like that. But, you know, Bryson was going to win tournaments whether he's hitting it like that or swinging it normal.
Yeah,
he was that good, and he is that good. And, you know, I'm not a massive fan, but, you know, you cannot fault the guy. The guy works hard.
Yeah, you know? I think that's the, you know, as you get older, you know, when we look at people, I always just respect. There's always something about them, wherever they are, you know, whether it works with my personality or not. There's something about them that you just have to respect. Arthur, you just said now, you know, and the younger guys and Michael, when it was, you know, in your days. But social media, when we talk about the pressure and making it a bit more difficult, do you think that plays a role with the youngsters today? Because, I mean, the Ernie Els and the Louis Oosthuizens, and they didn't have, you know, social media pressure. Do you think that plays a determining role at the moment in youngsters' life?
Well, it has to. But also, I think youngsters are more equipped now to be able to handle it, because you're going to have the haters.
Mm.
You know, the thing is, in my day of playing golf, and you know, I've got a great future behind me, okay, when it comes to playing. But, you know, my playing career was relatively short. And I managed to supplement it by playing senior tour events on a handful of occasions and stuff. But, you know, face to face, no one's going to tell you that You're an idiot to your face.
Yeah.
They're going to say that on social media.
Correct.
So the youngsters are now having to be a little bit harder, but a bit thicker skinned, okay? And, you know, there's a lot of guys who've crumbled because of the pressure, where you've got haters actually posting stuff about how terrible you are. And I think that a lot of that is, you know, sensationalism, and we look at that with, you know, with the Live Tour and that type. You've got people who hate that, but the seed's been planted from somewhere. But it's very easy on social media to voice an opinion. It's very, if I didn't like you, okay, and I put it on social media, and then I actually meet you, different story altogether. Yeah. So I think it's a bit more extreme, but also it's probably not taken with as much salt as it was, you know, before.
Yeah.
And you do get altercations, but, you know, they're so rare in golf, and that's where this game is so beautiful. You know, you look at the guys, even the guys that people don't like, okay, and the name Reed comes to fore. You know, he's not everyone's cup of tea, but you look, he's got a following, you know, and you probably, you know, I've met guys who were, and Tony Johnston, Okay, back in my day. So you probably you're nodding now. Okay, yeah, now Tony Johnston does commentary now, and you can identify any bird in any tree on any planet and the ho-ho down there. And Tony does a great job of commentary. He's the most fun. When I first actually met him, now because he had a twitchy wave, you know, if you're watching this, Tony, he had a very twitchy wave, and he was a slow player. Nowadays, he'd be regarded as a quick player because the game slowed down a bit. But I didn't like him just because of his mannerisms. When I met him, I fell in love with him. He is the most amazing human being. So when you actually physically engage with someone, but physically, not by an opinion formed by someone else or what you see.
You've got
a beautiful human being. So, you know, I can't say bad things about Reed because Patrick Reed, I haven't met him.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen stuff on TV, but, you know, end of the day, it also takes all types to make this game up. If everyone was perfect,
yeah,
you know, we'd probably be living a lie in our industry.
Absolutely.
But it's such an environment conducive to good people. You know, and I've got 4.5 hours with you. I better get along with you.
Correct.
So, lekker, you know, and afterwards we're going to have a beer.
Yeah, I think that the players have got this incredible opportunity if you just change your mindset, because we spoke about earlier, once I get to know Eric, you watch him differently. You know, when he's now watching the tournament. So he could just be one of the guys that flashes through. You know, you go, oh, Eric Van Nooyen, -7. But once you get to know him and you dive a little bit into his personality, now it's like a following. You want to watch every shot. You want him to – so it grows the following. And I think that the youngsters have this opportunity where through social media and other platforms like this, they can open up their hearts a little bit and their personalities. And then now when you get to know the guy, you actually watch him with a completely different view over the weekend.
Yeah.
Because to watch golf in orbit, it's a big commitment. And I like what social media has done, and I'd say embrace it. You know, it's got its negative connotations, but it's grown the game of golf. If I look at you, Michael, I see, you know, you booked out all the time. You're always busy somewhere. But it's not necessarily that it's driven through your social media. So,
yeah, I'm terrible on social media. I kind of get these like spurts of doing stuff and then not. But
is it just reputation in the market?
Yeah, look, I've been around, you know, like a really, you know, you mentioned my era, and it offends me. I still feel I'm a youngster. But now it is. Look, you know, the game of golf or the industry of golf. You know, I mean,
it's very small.
It's such a small little brotherhood, and everyone knows everyone. You know, and even though 138,000 people or whatever play golf in this country, you can bet your bottom dollar a lot of those people know each other. But getting back to that social media thing, Louis Oosthuizen singing on a plane.
Yeah.
Everyone has seen it.
Everybody.
And everyone now goes, yeah, he's actually quite a fun guy to be around, you know?
But that's what I mean.
And that is brilliant, you know? So, you know, I'm a happy-go-lucky guy. You know, I'd love to say, you know, I've been a massive success in business, and I'd beg to differ. But a positive outlook, and I honestly believe just being yourself, and that's who I am. I've always tried to have fun with everything I do. So, you know, it shines in my trick shot shows that I do. You know, can I say, you look like you're so much fun, and I love doing them. It's my time to shine. It's me showing off in front of 150 corporate golfers, okay, and showing them how bad they are sometimes, okay. But it's lekker. The canvas is the right one, you know, to go and have fun. Tell a few funny stories. Bend a few funny stories, bend a few truths as well. But it's all about fun. And, you know, that's the thing with golf. And I think that's where, you know, the traditionalist, I'm still a traditionalist.
Yeah.
You know, I'll very rarely wear shorts playing golf. And I've got sexy legs, eh? But it's just the traditional things. And also the PGA, you know, is quite a traditional group. But also there's evolution there, you know. So we wear our blazers on the final prize, it always looks brilliant. And it's lekker. It's nice to have that too. But in the same breath, I also came from an era where if you wanted to wear shorts, you had to wear long socks, the stockings. Okay. Why? Okay. Just because in Scotland they did, because the legs are cold. They needed the long socks. So, you know, traditional values, the game does that anyway. The rules of the game, the way the game is played. And the people that play the game are respectful, generally respectful people. So the traditional values are upheld just there, just in the way the game is structured. You know, jeans in a clubhouse. Those jeans cost way more than most pairs of golf trousers. Yeah. So, you know, to say that's not allowed. And it was just a natural progression. And now it's not even spoken about anymore. Once they had no jeans, no and when I mean, I joined my club back in the days, was the Wanderers. They called them, they didn't call them tackies.
Mm.
And they didn't call them sports shoes. They called them sand shoes. I don't know why, but nonetheless. Okay? And juniors weren't allowed to play on weekends. Look at where it's gone to now, and it's a great place. Golf is in such a good space. And you don't have to yap too many rules. You know, shirts and Bushy. Okay, James Small played a few rounds with golf. James's shirt was never in his trousers. Mm. And when he first joined Wanderers, I remember guys saying, please tuck your shirt in. Then who cares? Yes, there's a look that you want to, but you know, you look after yourself, I look after myself. If my shirt's untucked, please tell me because I want to know.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, but don't try and kick a guy off a golf course because, you know, his collar is half a centimeter not conforming. You know?
I've been kicked off a course for wearing white socks.
I was just going to
tell you. Under third hole, they came and fetched me with a golf cart. On the third hole, they followed me because I had to buy white socks. But I will be honest, I was a bit annoyed by it. So I refused to wear the white socks. And then on the third hole, they asked me to leave the golf course for white socks. And I had matching blue socks with my blue golf shoes. So that type of stuff just sits with me, and I just completely rebel against that from my own personal perspective on that. So I like you say that, Michael, because that's what we're trying to say. Golf is not like that, and especially not the people that are actually playing it. Maybe it has the perception in the boardroom and the air-conditioned offices. But when the game gets played, people are good to each other. If you're too slow, you let the people go in front of you. People buy drinks for each other all the time. We're good to the caddies. We build relationships with them. It's a fantastic game to get away. And my wife will tell you, if it wasn't for the game of golf, she'll be probably have divorced me by now. She loves it when I go out and just go into my nothing box for 6 hours. Michael, I just want to ask you, because I'm really impressed by your business sense in the golf side. And I know that you're very humble in what you say but you've developed this Bunkered Armor product that you've developed personally, and it's been going on for quite some time. But I don't think a lot of South Africans know about it. Mm-hmm. And when I saw it the first time, I thought it was quite reserved for the richest golf clubs in South Africa. So maybe just dilute that for us.
Okay, I won't get into too much detail, and it's quite technical. So I've always been an ideas guy. So for those of you watching and who've got hairlines like mine, used to look at the sprinkler heads for your distances, and then I put advertising on there and I patented it. So I've always had my mum was an artist, so I'll accredit her for a bit of creativity. But I got involved in golf sand, bunker sand supply, and it wasn't a particularly good business. Just there's not a massive demand for it. But after rainstorms was when the phone calls started coming in. And I looked at it, and I just turned it upside down. I said, it's not the sand in the bunkers. It's the liners that aren't performing. So in a bunker, a lot of guys say, oh, the bunkers are terrible, put more sand in there. But all you're doing is you're putting a very expensive sand in there that on the next rainstorm is going to get contaminated.
Contaminated with the balance, yeah.
So I looked at developing a bunker liner, okay, and it was quite simple for me, and I've always done that. I looked at a sprinkler at Wanderers, said 127. I said, oh, that's quite a nice place to put advertising. And there's a lot of them. So, you know, it was made sense. It wasn't a difficult thing. So for me, when I thought of developing a bunker liner, I asked myself just a few questions. I said, well, firstly, what is the problem with current bunker liners? And they were typically too hard, so if you hit it with a golf club, you'll damage your club. Or if you hit it with a brush cutter, it's going to, you know, the blade's going to get damaged or someone's going to get hurt. So I thought, okay, you can't be hard. And then also, after what they call a washout, after a rainstorm, they're exposed and they're ugly. They're black or they're gray or they're concrete or whatever. Or you've got a material on there that's shade netting, which was stolen off the club captain's carport. Whatever it was, okay, but they looked ugly. So I said, well, it's got to look like sand. And then I thought, okay, so it has to be made of the sand that you're putting in the bunkers, and then how do you bind it? Now, but it can't be hard. So I just thought of wax. I thought wax. And in those days, I thought of just candle wax. But, of course, it was the wrong thing. 184 waxes later, we came up with a solution because it would melt too early in the sunlight. And then we added some fiber just to give it a little bit of structural strength, or what we call matrix. And then started working with that and developed a bunker liner. Okay. So now after a rainstorm, the sand washes off. It still looks like the same sand that's in the bunker, so it's not ugly. So that's great. So you don't even notice. You can still play your bunker shot. You shouldn't be playing on the faces anyway. A lot of the other products, you insist on a lot of sand up, so you literally roll a ball and it's going to plug. And you know, the bunkers where we line bunkers, you've got 40% less sand in them because you've got a splash of sand up. You don't have to have a lot of sand up. But point being is this was all obvious stuff to me. And then we created this, originally four of us, and the guys went along with my journey, and now I've got my partner in Ireland. We relocated him a couple of seasons ago, so the business is set up there, and we're starting to put bunkers in internationally. But it was obvious, you know, to me, and I didn't see why no one had ever thought of it before, like with the sprinkler advertising story. And it was just so obvious that it needed to be done. And, you know, COVID killed us a little bit, but COVID was good for my business. And I think for a lot of businesses, when you're in it, it was horrible. You know, no money.
Yeah.
But we didn't have any overheads. We weren't employing people. So we were very, very lucky. We didn't have massive expenses on machinery. And essentially, we came out of it. And you're offering now golf clubs cost savings and return on investment. So, yes, there's no such thing as a cheap bunker liner. There's a cheap solution, but it comes back. You know, there's always been that theory that a short-term solution will present you a long-term problem. So, and also, goedkoop is duurkoop.
Yeah.
So if you put something in cheap, it's going to come back to burn you.
Yeah.
So the problem is with a lot of golf clubs is they go down a journey with the wrong product, and they've spent good money on it.
So they're in it.
Okay, so they're in it. And now the thing is, most of the clubs are committee-driven, and now imagine going back to your members and saying, sorry, we need to redo that. And they say, well, you just redid it. It's going to be a hard pill to swallow for your members to go down the route again. So, you know, what I try to do from a business perspective was just to slow the decision-making down and say to the guys, don't panic, review, research, and look at it. And we've been very lucky with Bunker Armor. We had a lot of years of putting test sites in and up against other products. And then against other products where we didn't get the deal, but ours was still in the test sites. And guys could then go and have a look and say, ooh, this has actually done very, very well, or it's outperformed. So we've been very fortunate. We've had a lot of big-name golf clubs who've now used our product in their bunkers. And it's been brilliant for us. But it's been a waiting game. And it's taken many, many years. We're now year eight of existence.
Okay.
And only now we're starting to actually look at this business being profitable. We're starting in Ireland in the next few weeks, and we're starting in the UK, in England in the next few months, and then next year we launch in the States. So we've been very fortunate. But you know, time was our friend; it was our enemy when I was in lockdown. Yeah. You know, trying to work out how we're going to do stuff. So to answer the question, it's not cheap. It's not cheap, but you know, a bunker is the Achilles heel of most golf courses when it comes to maintenance.
Maintenance.
And you know, if you have to line item, which is a new trend now, thank goodness. Before, the poor greenkeeper was always asked for stuff, and no, but it's in your general maintenance.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a look at from a proper cost analysis perspective, everything needs to be line item. How much do bunkers cost? So after a rainstorm, how long does it take you to recover? Well, how many staff do you have to deploy? How many water pumps? How much petrol is used in those water pumps? Your bunker rakers.
The cost to serve.
So you're actually looking at physical line item costs. And, you know, golf clubs now, we get calls now where the guys say, well, we've had so many people complain about our bunkers. And that's the place where they're going to complain about.
Yeah.
You know, greens are easily fixable. Bunkers, it's a very expensive exercise. So we, in lockdown, we also thought, how could we make it more affordable for clubs that might not be, you know, might not have the capital available to them? And it took a couple of calls and a couple of meetings, and First Rand came on board and said, well, finance it. So now we've created another thing altogether where you, instead of, like you finance a fleet of golf carts, you can finance your bunkers. So, and guys aren't used to it. They almost seem to be a bit uncomfortable because They could never finance
the
you know the renovation of their greens.
But well, that says a lot about your product, that they believe in it, that it can be amortized over a particular period, and the bank stands behind it.
So that's so, incredible. Yeah, so it's been really good, and you know, we haven't had – and golf clubs typically that at this stage have afforded our bunker, bunker armor, the bunker liner, have created slush funds or fundraising through adding an additional fee on green fees and stuff like that. But most certainly, you know, I urge golf clubs and golf club managers and committee members just to go and line, go and itemize what it costs. And, you know, the sand is massively expensive. Mm. It's massively expensive. But, you know, we've had one particular bunker, and we're busy at Country Club Johannesburg at the moment redoing, well, when I say we, Golf Data, who've also embraced our product. And they did the same at Copperleaf. They did a wonderful job of installing there. They're busy now at Rocklands at CCJ. The sand that's in that bunker, in our trial bunker from almost 5 years ago, is exactly the sand we put in. And
no
it's still
ways.
Fairly white. So we protect the sand. That's what the point of a bunker liner is. You know, and so that you know, it wasn't, you know, once they'd seen it, and you had three committee changes in the meantime. And the guys are saying, well, that's obvious that we have to go. And, you know, we thank our lucky stars for a thing called time. As frustrating as it was to sit back and go, I've got my money in the ground. We finance those bunkers ourselves. We benchmark ourselves with the other premium liners. So we're the same the same price. I mean, how they sell it might be different.
Okay, but same price.
Same price, yeah. So, but, you know, then in fairness, there's cheaper options. And I say options, not solutions.
Yeah.
So a lot of the clubs go with a and a short-term solution being some type of like a shade netting. And shade netting wasn't developed to be in a bunker, but it does serve a purpose. Okay. And it, let's call it 47 Rand a square meter, okay, over my product, which will probably, and also depending on where it is, at close to 500 Rand a square meter, it's a no-brainer to go with a shade netting.
But doesn't it give five times the value?
Here we go. So I had a very prominent gentleman in the turf management business a few years ago. One of the other ladies came to him and said, "Yeah, have you heard about this bunker?" And I was standing there with him, and he said, "Yeah, well, yeah, it's unbelievable, but it's expensive. So for the same price, you can redo your bunkers every 5 years." And I looked at him and I said, "Well, why do you want to?"
Yeah.
Why would you want to disrupt play, close your golf course every 5 years if you've got something that'll last for 10? You know, and exactly that. So it answers itself. So, you know,
so also, value exceeds price.
We have a lot of guys saying, "Oh, well, it's too expensive to use your product." And I go, "Well, it's too expensive not to."
Mm.
And they outweigh each other. So the ROI, if you do the numbers in terms of the actual cost of bunker maintenance and going the cheaper, nasty route. So I challenge the guy and say, "Okay, put that in there. And in 2 years' time, you've got people upset with it. You have to then go one hole by one hole. You probably have to redo all your drainage again, redo that again, disrupt golf. And then what are you going to put in next time?" Because also now you tell your committee you're doing exactly the same thing you did last time.
Mm.
They're going to say, "No, we don't agree with that." So, you know, do it properly and do it the first time. We offer the guarantees on it, which, you know, we're pedantic about that. And the returns speak for themselves. So the guys recover their money. And they don't only recover their money, but they save money down the line as well. So it's just general business sense. And the bunkers that are lined with bunker armor look unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, we got no limitations. A lot of the other ones, guys were starting to grow grass down the faces. To have a flat-based bunker. But some top golf courses, you can't see the bunkers anymore. The intimidation factor's gone. The design of the Gary Player golf course or whatever, the Jack Nicklaus golf course, was designed with a high bunker face to frame the hole. Now the frame's gone. You just see a grass bank. And grass banks become massively problematic because you can't mow them on a steep face. Mm. You've got to take a fly mow equivalent and try and mow it, but now you can't mow it to an exact height. So it becomes rough within your fairway, essentially. So those are all those little, you know, the technical things or the shortfalls that come from not doing it properly.
Yeah.
But as I say, we've been very fortunate. Golf Data, embrace it. And we've got, you know, a lot of guys who are really keen on getting involved in the product. And the product, we charge the same price regardless. You know, we try and keep the price that it's recommended retail. And then the guys make money from installing it, etc. But yeah, I mean, it's a great product. And, you know, we've been very fortunate. We've been contacted by a couple of clubs overseas now and a couple of designers and constructors who want to do it. And we also put it in lockdown. It was that easy to install that we actually installed online virtual.
No way.
In Australia. So we, you know, I wanted to go to Australia a couple of years ago, and the guys were saying, well, come down and see us. And I'm like, well, it's expensive to get there. Suddenly lockdown, you make a call and say, listen, we're going to do a Zoom call. Oh, yeah, okay, no problem.
Perfect.
And we wind up installing, literally, you know, using, you know, WhatsApp FaceTime.
Mm.
And it worked out really well. So we'll be getting going there quite soon. But yeah, so, you know, the opportunities in this game, you know, I was very fortunate now to win the PGA Entrepreneur of the Year.
I saw that, yeah.
And it's not hard. We've got this industry that just has these lights that are going off, going, please do something here. You know, Arthur, I mean, what you've done with fitting. You know, there are guys who've done it as well.
Mm.
But to the extent you're doing it, there's such a massive opportunity. Yeah. You know, and I used to do a trick shot show. It's also part of the entrepreneurship thing for the PGA. And all the new recruits come in, and, you know, at Royal Johannesburg, you've got 20 guys there coming for their first series of lectures. And then I'm doing a trick shot show. And then I always ask the question, what do you want to do? And they go, this guy wants to play. He wants to be an administrator. At the end of the day, you know, you might not be an Ernie Els or a, you know, an Eric Van Rooyen or those guys. But there's so many opportunities. Mm-hmm. I was a playing professional golfer. And I've been in golf course advertising. I've designed IT systems in the golfing industry. I've managed professional golfers. I've done golf tourism. I ran corporate golf days. I do trick shot shows. I've done TV stuff. I do build bunkers, you know. There's so many opportunities for any guy getting into the industry. You'd be a fool to believe that there's no opportunities. And like your space, you know, FlightScope. Proudly South African innovation. You know, not to do it would have been nonsensical.
No, absolutely.
You know, and it's now the biggest brand in its field.
Absolutely.
Okay, by a mile.
Yeah.
Okay, and all because one guy, instead of taking things that were firing out of a muzzle of a cannon, okay, went, okay, well, we can use this for sports. And you look where that's gone to. So, you know, that's just innovation and entrepreneurship. Follow the idea, you know.
Yeah, I think Henry would have said the same thing to you to there, you know. And that's why I wanted Arthur and them, you know, with us on this, because the South African version. Yeah, we've got FlightScope, the company. They've got global offices around the world, used by some of the best coaches and players in the world. And most people didn't even realize the impact that was made out of Stellenbosch still to this day. I think 370 people plus there. You can just imagine the economic footprint for parts, you know. I always say when you have a building in South Africa, you know, you've got painting, you've got maintenance on that building, you've got salaries, that it's a contribution towards SARS and et cetera and et cetera. So I always encourage any sort of economical footprint or playing a part in it. And, you know, look at their business. I won't go into their turnovers and stuff like that, but yeah, Arthur and Marie, how they sort, well, how do I get my clubs sorted out? And they couldn't find the right solution for it, so they said that we'll do it. Mm-hmm. And now, 5 years later, they've got Woodhill, Copperleaf, Four Ways. Paul Valley is in discussions. I won't go further with other locations. But that's the type, and I said to them, if they weren't a brand with integrity and reputation, those clubs won't bring them in.
Mm, 100%.
Because you now associate yourself with whatever that, you know, and that's why from the beginning, you know, we spoke about to Eric with youngsters in the golf, don't have an attitude, be a humble person, you know, be confident. I love what the way you've put it there with Gary Play, because I think I'm also switching my own mindset on that. Even though Gary didn't irritate me, I think him jumping up and down is just incredible at his age. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of his son, but that's a different.
At the moment, I think he is either. So.
Yeah, I think that's a different conversation. But to me, that's just the encouraging. And Michael, you sitting here today and speaking to us and seeing what you've done and also not being unapologetic about anything. You were so brutal about, you know, cash flow year, and we were worried about this and lockdown and what we were going to do here. That's the type of stuff that opens the conversation, because people think you have to get it right all the time. If I don't, you know, if I don't make money now, I'm a loser. And I'm talking about literally that's how people are. Mm. I don't make it on the Sunshine Tour. I'm now a failed golfer. Mm. Whoa. You can do so much else in golf. You can contribute towards it. You can inspire, motivate. You can innovate in the game of golf. You know, it doesn't have to, if you don't cut it on the Sunshine Tour, how many players in the NFL basketball, they only play to a certain college, you know, and then after college, they go into coaching and et cetera. That's not seen as a failure. That's seen as wow.
Failure is part of success. And at 52, you know, you should, I wish I'd learned a lot of this stuff earlier. You know, I've once again been very fortunate who I've met and who I've surrounded myself with. And I don't do any business with them at the moment, and hopefully in the future. But a guy like Peter Matkovich, okay, so Peter Matkovich, obviously originally a Zimbabwean, but recognized South African now, okay, one of the greatest golf course designers on the planet, and that's fact, okay. And Peter gets his hands dirty. I've watched him. He'll pick up the earth and he'll crunch it in his hand, and he's got amazing vision. But even Peter in his early days, and Peter's a hard guy, okay? He's a lovely gentleman, but he's hard, and he knows how good he is. Okay, but Peter Matkovich, at one stage in his life, when it came to design, didn't make mistakes. But you'd get there, and you'd play, and I'm going to mention it because I actually had this conversation with him, and the 18th hole at Centurion had a big pimple in the middle of it. And everyone was like, what's that doing there? No, it was supposed to be there. And eventually he realized that you don't get it right the first time. And that pimple disappeared. And there were a couple of greens as well at your old home golf course at Royal Swazi where there was – the undulations were just too extreme. But you don't get it right the first time. So you just go and fix it up for the next time. And there's no – you don't need to make apologies, okay, for fixing something that might not have been 100%. And that's where I honestly believe that you learn from your mistakes. – And failure, there's no such thing as failure. Only you've only failed if you don't continue to try.
Correct.
You know, so exactly with that. I mean, with bunker armor, I just told you, we went to 184 different types of wax to eventually get to where we are now.
I mean, imagine you said on 146, you go, that's too much.
You know, and Colonel Sanders. I mean, there's a lovely story. And I don't know if it's urban legend. But apparently on his 1,000th meeting, he got his investors. Took him 1,000 meetings. Imagine how despondent you'd be after 980 failed meetings.
Where after today, I would say there's a culture. After 3 attempts, I'll just give up.
Yeah.
You know, then it's like moving on to the next thing. There is definitely a culture of that consuming. And when you speak about the bunkers, we also have this perception where you just need to go and give. I always say, if people don't buy into the concept originally, I don't judge them for it, because maybe we haven't done it good enough to show that, hold on, I hear what you're saying on cost, but if we really start determining the value, the line item cost, in fact, this is going to cost you 10% more, but give you 50% more longevity. Therefore, it's a far better proposal to accept and to see the value in. But nowadays, it feels like there's a lot of youngsters, they go in, they go out, and I always show, you know, forgive me, when and that's why I wanted you to talk about your businesses, because you see on Instagram, this guy's 330 BMW or a Mercedes, some fancy car, a watch that he's wearing, and I always just look at that, and I'm like, why do you show me that? Show me the offices you built in order to buy that. Show me the training that you did. You know, now we sit here, Eric is now successful, but it's like, excuse me, you can't sit here and say, oh, Eric has got it so nicely. He put years and years of sacrifices. When we were, you know, when you sitting and having fun, he was there 6 o'clock in the morning and hitting 180 balls. I just think that people don't understand what goes on behind the scenes. And then eventually it just tips over.
But even then, a guy like Eric now, I mean, I met his wife outside. She was waiting for him because they got one car.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
he could most certainly afford
definitely
3 cars.
It's an Avanza.
And, you know, I saw that too. And exactly, keep it humble.
Yeah.
You know, look, I don't have enough money to buy expensive watches and my car barely made it here. But, you know, point is that I think your appreciation for things change and the scale of which you judge stuff. For me, you know, I suppose when I was a youngster, if you'd asked me what would have been my favorite car, it would have been something with a fin on the back or whatever. Someone said to me the other day, what is be your ideal car? If you had all the money in the world, what car would you buy? And I said, a Toyota Prado.
Mm. Yeah.
Perfect for me.
Yeah.
Big enough, strong enough, whatever. I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy who wants to drive in with a fancy car. Not that I have the resources to, but point being is that I'm quite happy with what I've got. You know, when times are tough, you know, you learn to scrape the you learn life through scraping the bottom of the barrel. And we've all been there at some stage. Some people haven't, but at some stage I think you have to appreciate things in life for what they are. And you know, many of the most highly successful people don't make a lot of money. And that's okay. Mm. As long as they're living the life that they're choosing, you know.
But they contributed so much.
Exactly. And you know, I get back to my mate Dave Usendorf, okay, who was my mentor. And you know, Dave just lives such a lacquer life. He's not a flashy guy. He spends a lot of time with his boys and his wife Elrie. They play a lot of golf. He travels. But he's not a flashy guy. He doesn't come in, you know, rolling into a room with a fancy watch on his arm. He's a distinguished gentleman.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, he's as humble. You wouldn't know if you met Dave whether he was worth gazelle billions or just a few rand. Mm. And that's, you know, that as I say, he's my mentor, and I'm proud of that because he's a lovely, lovely human being. But exactly that. You know, don't measure your life by a car or whatever. And it's lekker to see. You know, like a guy like Eric, who's just such a humble guy. You know, I met Eric in his first year as a pro, and he hasn't changed, not one iota. And most professional golfers are like that. I had a very engaging conversation with Brandon Stone. I still remember holding him when he was a baby, okay? And he's still got no respect for me. I'll still take his money on the golf course. You know, still a lovely young man. And once again, also, I think a lot of guys said at one stage, oh, it's too arrogant. No, he's just confident. And, you know, he's won a Scottish Open to prove it. He won the South African Open. So, you know, that's – people say about Gary Player, and they say, yeah, you know, that attitude and that ego of his. If he didn't have that attitude that he had, he would have won no majors. He won 9 majors, 9 senior majors, and I'm probably going to cock it, about 148 international titles. I think Mr. Player will say a little bit more than that, but – you don't do that by not backing yourself.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Exactly. Back yourself. You know, obviously there's some ideas that people look at ludicrous and, you know, some things aren't going to work out. But if you've got, once again, it's not hard to find ideas. In this game, I mean, Arthur, what you do, okay, you think about it. Cars are spending, and let's just take the average retail price on a new driver now. Let's call it 10,500 rand retail. Do your research.
Mm.
Make sure. If you're spending 10,500 rand on a driver, make sure. Mm. And if it costs you an extra 1,000 rand to have it custom fitted, that it's going to work for you. And the manufacturers love this guy. Why? Because they buy, let's just call it the Titleist driver, the latest Titleist D2 driver, okay?
TSR soon.
And they buy this thing, and they don't hit it well. Well, you're going to buy a Titleist the next time. Mm. No chance. Okay, so the manufacturers want that guy to go to Arthur and get fitted properly because they know that when they come up with a new one, they're going to Arthur. And it's obvious. So those are the things, like club fitting now. And, you know, I don't know if you know Derek Scholar.
Yeah.
You see, he's just done a mobile one. And I've known Derek just from playing, so I don't know him as a fitter. But what a good idea.
Mm.
He'll come to your office and do it. And I'm pretty sure you guys have also got that in your plan as well. But it's exactly what you need. I mean, the tour, you used to have the van.
The mobile van,
so he's done that. But now for average Joe. So those things are pioneering the way. And, I mean, I was at one stage thinking, with my trick shot shows, have a trailer. Because if it rains, how am I going to do a trick shot show? And for me to set up with sound and all that, the stuff that I do in lights.
It's a big mission.
So it was to actually create a trailer with a roof that pops up. It actually opens up on the sides and it's a stage. You know, and if I had enough money, I would have probably done it. But those kind of things.
Mm.
You know, and Chuck Heiter was charging, I think, $50,000 a show. He could afford to do that kind of thing. But he only do 3 shows a year.
Mm.
Okay? But, you know, those ideas... And for fitting vans and stuff, that, it makes a lot of sense. It's not hard to think of these things.
No.
You know, the simulators thing. So, you know, I've done a couple of simulator installations and, you know, with your FlightScope product. And part of my last, before Andrew Gunn passed away from the PGA, he was in charge of the learnership program there. And I used to do the trick shot shows. And I'd say to the guy, you know, coaching, yeah, there's not enough positions available. And I said, well, you don't need to be at a club. Have you got a garage? Yeah. Have you got a high enough ceiling? Yeah.
Mm.
So why don't you start a simulator center in your in your garage? You don't need to be employed at a club to be able to get a coach. If you've got your PGAs, you're registered and certified and accredited a coach, and you can do it anywhere. The simulation nowadays, it was just a no-brainer for me. I mean, I love coaching. I still do quite a bit of coaching at the Golfers Club, as you're aware.
Yeah.
They're all flight-scoped out there.
Yeah.
I love coaching on simulation. Okay? And it's obvious why. Okay, so if I'm coaching a guy and it's by eye, I could actually be wrong by a few degrees here and there.
Mm.
Those machines, they don't make information up.
No.
You've got the raw data. And for those of you watching, if you ever want to know how to fix your golf swing, learn a thing called ball flight laws. Okay, there's five of them. They're remedial. Okay? It's firstly, it's club head speed, which is everyone wants more of that. Then you've got your
club path.
This is me giving this lesson. Okay,
the two specialists, go for it.
Okay. So you've got club head speed, then you've got club face angle, which determines where the ball is going to finish. Okay. Then you've got swing path, where typically where the ball starts, but that's the line on which the club is traveling when it meets the ball and creates what we call axis spin and combined with where your club face is aiming. 85% of where the ball finishes is determined by your club face angle. Where was the club face aiming? So chances are if you hit it over there, your club face was aiming over there. That's as simple as it is. Then swing path will give you your dynamic with bringing the club to the ball and creating what we call axis spin, which is hook or slice or fade or draw, and every now and then someone hits it straight. Have you ever met anyone who hits it straight consistently?
Not a lot.
Not too many, right. Okay, it's too hard. Okay. Then you've got angle of attack, which is the downward or the upward motion of the club reaching the golf ball, okay? And that creates either – there's no such thing as top spin in golf. Can I put that out there? There's no such thing other than a top shot, and that you're not going to be proud of. But you'll have either less backspin or more backspin. And that's Arthur's job to find a shaft that will get you less backspin, typically with a driver, and then accordingly with the irons. So you've got the angle of attack, which determines the spin on the golf ball. And then the last one, which we often overlook, is the centeredness of strike, the sweet spot. Where did you hit it? Toe, heel, bottom, top, or middle? And then, heaven forbid, that using the shaft on that. One. Okay. So, but once you understand those and you look at those numbers, I can tell Joe Public there exactly what's happening with the club at impact, which it doesn't matter. Jim Furyk, what's his name?
Matthew Wolf.
Okay. I mean, Jim Furyk, David Ferretti said, if he had to describe Jim Furyk's swing, it's like an octopus falling out of a tree. Okay. So it's got lots of movements, but he delivers the club to the ball perfectly.
At impact.
And he knows exactly how it works. So it doesn't matter how you get it there, but down there, those ball flight laws kick in, and then you go further with more data. Okay. But just on those, I'm a better coach than ever before because I can see the numbers and I can tell the guy categorically that's what's happening. So those, I mean, it was a no-brainer guys have gone with the Mevo Plus now with all the simulation. So go and get a simulator. If a guy says he doesn't have time to play golf, well, go and play in your garage at night time.
Mm.
Okay. And I've done a number of installations of simulators for friends and some quite top guys, okay? And it's logical. And for the price that you guys are, the price point you guys are putting it in at, it's a no-brainer. And that's why guys like Eric have do this stuff at home. There's talk of when the guys, and there's a rain delay, okay, at a tournament. The guy goes back to his hotel room and goes and plays the last three holes on the simulator of the same course. So, you know, that is innovation. It was frowned upon at one stage. Now look where it is.
Yeah, it's embraced. I mean, you know, Arthur and them, when I, you know, there's two contexts to it. I came to a customer the one day and there was over 200, I can't quote exactly, but it was over 200,000 rands worth of clubs, 18,000 rand shafts and all sorts of stuff. And Arthur and Marais, they were literally putting everything in perfect place, you know, as the owners of the business, like I'm into the last detail. But then again, that perception is it's an expensive thing. But then if you actually go to them, it's the same cost as to a retail store, but now you're getting actually fitted perfectly for purpose. And on the simulator side, before I even got into it, I thought to myself, it has to serve a purpose. So we did a school exercise. I won't mention the school now, but they just installed them in their school systems. We gave them back 151 hours a week between all their schools, from the bus traveling to the golf course. We gave that time back to them. And they could market that as a broader scheme. And like I said to somebody the other day, it's what a game changer. Mm. You have to sit for 40 minutes on a bus to go to the nearest golf course, which we all know is dead time. You know, it's going to where you chirp your mates and do all of that. And we said, well, bring back some purpose towards it. So it's never been the fancy side of simulation that's always impressed me. And if you also look at FlightScope, why I really appreciate what Henry did is everybody was aiming only to the 1% of golfers. And then he decided and said, well, how do I grow the game for everybody and make it more feasible? And what people don't know, as an engineering company, you first make a loss on your units until volume and mass kicks in. And the first months is losses because you put that back into the game. And then eventually your scale, you know, it determines your profit in the background. So, you know, now it's tens of thousands of units that's gone into the market. But Henry never saw it that way. For him, he was just an engineer. It was easy. I saw the opportunity. You should make it slightly smaller, make it more feasible, more cost effective. Why do you need to do that? Why do you have to sponsor 2 million rand to a company and then put that price onto the consumers? So that type of stuff. And that's why I appreciate your time so much today. And Arthur and Marie being part of this, because it's, we need to highlight ourselves a little bit. And I don't mean ourselves as a brand here particularly, but the people sitting on the couches. Because I want South Africans to have a different perception. We don't need to look overseas for things all the time. We don't need to look at, oh, I want to follow that guy in the United States and I want to follow that European player. We have incredible players that you can learn from, get the journeys from, and it's accessible to everybody. So, Michael, I'm so grateful that you were here today. Arthur, I don't know if you wanted to...
Yeah, Mike, thanks for being here today. You didn't let me say much today.
I never do let anyone talk.
No, but on a real note, I don't think anyone would ever say a bad thing about Mike. He's a great guy in the golf industry. He's done a lot for the game. And thank you for being here. And yeah, I'm sure we'll get you back on the couch soon.
Okay, no, thanks guys for having me. And nice to see, you know, you've grown up from a 12-year-old into a very successful guy. And then also... just to you guys, I mean, you know, also I attended that one talk with the PJ, the online one with Henry, and he's an outstanding human being, and he's an innovator, and he's an inventor. And there was, you know, I look around a lot, and you learn to admire guys like that, you know. Thank you for allowing me the privilege, and then also for the great product. I mean, really, you guys have an outstanding product, and I'm always there to punt it.
Thank you, Mike.
And, you know, the Golfers Club, where I do a little bit of coaching. You know, it's only FlightScope there. So, you know you're onto a good thing. You've also got other business interests as well. And Arthur, you know, I've watched your business grow immensely, and also the hard effort that, you know, the effort you put in. And it can only continue, and it's about the passion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've watched you at Copperleaf there, and you really, you know, you don't even have to, in life, you don't have to have the best product.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have the passion behind your product, you know, you're nowhere. And not saying you don't have the best product. I'm just saying just in general, you know, you've got to just keep on believing. And as long as you've got something that is realistic, you know, you'll be okay. And we'll probably do a couple of – I'm going to get you to come and hit a couple of trick shots just now because we're going to have a little bit of fun. I think
that'll
be a nice way to sort of cap it off.
Yeah,
it'll probably break a couple of roofs and stuff. Yeah. But
I'm ready to do it.
Facility. But we're gonna have a little bit of fun. But thanks for getting me in.
It's a pleasure.
And also to the viewers of this is gonna be fun. I think the Human Golf Show is gonna really be great fun. And you've got such I've never known whether to say plethora or plethora, but I think it's a plethora of great guests. Dale Hayes, you might just have to make it a little bit wider here. You know, if you get Hutchie in there, you better have a bottle nearby.
Bottle nearby.
You know, and Hutchie, thanks, buddy. You're an inspiration, hey?
Dave.
And Uzi. I mean, you've got to have Usendorf here. And Uzi, you know, you'll be able to kick – you won't be able to kick him out. He'll be staying here for a while.
And it seems like his son, Michael, is on the same path, you know, in the golf industry. Copy and paste.
A mini-me. Without a doubt.
And just, David, you know, those that Michael, you, I was quite new when I came into it, and you were the first guys to just open your heart to me entirely. Mm. And I'm really grateful for that. And I want that to encourage other people to also do the same. Let's be approachable to each other. Mm. You know, he might be just starting off somewhere in golf, but we need to embrace each other than more say like, oh, you're not good enough and you're not there where I am yet. I think we need to open each other's arms a little bit more. Let the 1%ers fight it out at the top, but we, you know, maybe Arthur sits in that 1%. I can't say for myself, but I am really appreciative, and that I know it's a lot of thank yous, Michael, but it is really, you're incredible, incredible human. And that's why we wanted you so badly on here to come and speak to it, because you've made an impact in my life and you've made an impact on Arthur's life and from a far earlier age. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks
a lot.
On the next episode of The Human Golf Show.
A few months later, I'm at home and my phone rings. It's a number I don't recognize. Hello? Dave Gary, player. Jeez, Mr. Player, how are you? Well, I've exchanged pleasantries. He said, listen, my boy, I've got an entourage of press out here from the US. And we're doing my new book is going to be my 18 favorite holes in South Africa. And I've done most of them, but I'm stuck on the 11th hole at Royal Johannesburg in Kensington. So, well, Mr. Player, you know, I don't have a story for you right off the top of my head, but if I apply my mind, I'll think of something, I'll do some homework, and I'll come back to you with a cool story about the 11th. So there's a pause, and he goes, didn't you hear about that prick whose taser gun went off in his pocket?